Well, I certainly enjoyed reading The Mojo Blues. It was this was the first novel, and it was so well crafted. It felt to me as if you had been writing for a long time.
I have been writing on that particular one for a long time.
Tell me about it. Tell me how this book evolved and the process of writing and when you started this at all.
I started that book 13 years ago. I started it 13 years ago. I had been out of the Army about 2, maybe 3 years. And I decided, and I'd always, as a youngster, wanted to be a writer, but had not really moved on it. And it was the summer of 73. I wasn't in school that year, that summer. I was in school at the time, and at Memphis State in Memphis, Tennessee. And I decided that I was getting a little old and that if I was going to be a writer, I better start writing. I sat down to write and couldn't write. I was somewhat shocked. And I started out writing a Vietnam novel. Ended up having to go to, I went and sat in a workshop at Memphis State that summer. And I was told that I had a little talent, that I should probably pursue it. So John Killens was running a workshop at Columbia at the time that was open to the community. So I came to New York for the summer of 73, expecting to write the novel, get a Nobel Prize, and go home by September, get back in school. It didn't work quite like that. I guess the first 6 years I spent learning the tricks of the trade. I was working on this novel, but I more read my first chapter in different workshops around the city and got a lot of kudos for it. And then about 5, 6 years ago, I realized that if I was going to get this novel written, that I would have to really sit down and work on it. And I sat down and worked on it.
Well, now, 13 years working on this off and on, and then, of course, a more intensive period toward the end. But what were you doing to survive during this period? You had to have some sort of support.
For a while I lived off my Vietnam vet education check, and I lived frugally.
Were you on the GI Bill?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And I lived frugally, and that lasted for till 1980. Ongoing, but in pieces. And I've had a variety of literary jobs. I was working with the CETA literary program for a couple of years. I've taught creative writing workshops. I've sold articles. The classic starving young novelist route, living in a garret, the whole little bit.
I don't know. Somehow I fancied you living in a house on stilts. Did you do that?
No, I didn't.
Is there such a house in Memphis?
No, there is. Well,
that was a nice touch.
There is a house, but it's not in the park that I put it in. And there is a house that is up on the stilts, but no, it isn't where I put it. It is not the house that I used.
Tucep Hayajian, is he much like yourself?
A lot of me is in Tucep. However, he is a fictional character, and
wages.
Yeah, a lot of me is in Tucep. I wrote the book out of my own experiences, but it is fiction, and I put a lot of licks on it. I was not in combat in Vietnam, whereas Tucep was. I am more of a student of hoodoo rather than a practitioner. There's a lot of me in Tucson, but no, there are a lot of other people that I have run across in my days and time in Tucson.
You also have a background as a musician, don't you?
Now that's stretching it somewhat. I was surprised when I saw blues singer down there. In the same way that I'm a student of hoodoo, because it's one of the major symbols of my novel there, I'm also a student of the blues. And in studying the blues, I began to play it and play the mouth harp. And when I'm at readings that I've done, because I myself get bored with a lot of prose at readings, I develop this act this dramatic act that comes out of my novel. And at the beginning of it, I do sing the blues and blow my harmonica, my mouth harp.
You have a dramatic act that comes out of the novel? I mean, how does this... Tell me, go into a little more detail about that.
Well, part of it is the blues, singing the blues and blowing the mouth harp. And part of it is doing this hoodoo act element. The blues and the mouth harp I developed because it loosens my audiences up. Once I get to singing the blues and blowing my harp and get the audience to shouting and hollering and, you know, bouncing in their seats, they're ready to accept anything I tell them after that. So it became part of my act. And a couple of people that doesn't had caught the act. So when I saw the copy for the cover, it had blues singer down there before Ryder. I said, oh, you know. Now, since then, I've been trying to develop my act somewhat since I've got to live up to it now.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the structure of the book. Here we have three Vietnam veterans who come back to the United States. They go their different ways, and of course at the end they have a reunion. Now, it was interesting to me about the use of language in the Mojo Blues. And so I want to ask you to interpret some of the words, because you can actually, it's like anything else. You can fill in, even if you don't know it, it's like reading a good piece of poetry. You may not understand everything that's being said in the poem, but you have a feeling for it, and you can understand it, and you can interpret and fill in. So I want to ask you for some interpretation, because this language is sprinkled throughout the book, and it works very, very nicely. It works. One of the things that I think I was able to figure out was the term DAP and DAP line. I presume that is like a Black Power salute or something.
DAP is a Black Power handshake was pretty prevalent in Vietnam. It was the elaborate handshake. It could have gone, in different areas of Vietnam, it was different. And then they had one that was a lingua franca for all of Vietnam. And the DAP line was this line that wherever there in the EM clubs or wherever there were a group of blacks, there would be a line alongside of the wall, one of the walls. And when you came into the club, you were expected to go down the DAP line and DAP everybody, which, being a involved, complicated maneuver, it took some time, you know. And
you have that's a very nice scene in the book. Uh-huh. Yeah, you have that in the book. A very nice scene. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's what DAP is. It's a handshake. It's a very elaborate, complicated handshake.
Well, where does the word DAP come from?
I don't know. It was there when I got there. I don't know what.
Page 8.
Mm-hmm.
They pushed him after her. Go ahead, blood. Boku dap wa meden. Number one, Bic. You owe it to yourself. Can you interpret that line?
Boku dap wa meden.
Okay.
Now number one, Bic.
Say that. All right, you say it now. Say that.
Boku dap wa meden. That was GI lingo in Vietnam, composed of French, Vietnamese, and American, which was what the Vietnamese used to speak to us, so that we picked it up. Buku was French, meant big or large. Dap, or much in this case. Dap meant fine, and dapwa meant fine. So, you know, whenever you would be referring to some woman in Vietnam, buku dapwa meant very fine, you know. Me then meant black. Basically that sentence said, she's very fine, brother. You owe it to yourself was another phrase that was very much a Vietnam phrase. That was just a phrase that the troops used a lot. You owe it to yourself. Which was just used a lot. You know, whenever someone was saying you should do something for your own good, it was, you owe it to yourself.
Okay. High Pockets Brother. What is a High Pockets Brother?
High pockets, long legs. So long legs, so the pockets on the pants sit high.
Black and Eyes. I think I can guess that one.
Yeah, that's that was another Vietnam phrase that we used for the sense of black identity that was developed in Vietnam. We called it blackenization.
Peep them.
Peep, see.
I think, no, on page 10 it was peep them. Peep
yeah,
them.
Well, I saw them. See, peep is see.
See.
Yeah, so okay. It would be saw, I saw them, or whatever the context was.
What's a convict? I think you might have referred to that.
Convict is part of that of Vietnam lingo. Convict was, do you understand? Convict, do you understand?
What do you do, this on page 31, when you bogart, when you are bogarting cars?
Bogarting cars?
Bogarting cars. Page 31.
I don't remember that one, but yes. Bogart means to, Bogart comes from here in the States. Bogart is a takeoff from Humphrey. And it means being tough.
Yeah, he rode home hard, pedal to the metal, bogarting cars.
Yeah,
in front
it means
of
being tough, intimidating in the bogey style. Bogart. To bogart somebody is to, you know.
I should have gotten that one. All right. Now, page 52. Is it bougie?
Yeah, bougie. Bougie. Bougie is bourgeois. And it's bougie is a term of. A condescending term to refer to the black bourgeois, the black middle class.
Now here's one on page 93. It's lame. Now,
lame.
I don't know how. What? I can't remember what in context that was.
Probably meant not sharp, faltering, stumbling, not quick, not alert.
What happens? When somebody, a pitch a fit, what happens? What is that?
Throw a tantrum. Get upset and uncouth.
You integrate these words seamlessly throughout the book, so they look like they match. I mean, they fit extremely nicely.
Thank you.
Now, you have a lot about hoodoo, which is, of course, as you establish, a hobby of yours. And when you talk about mojo, you're talking about some element in hoodoo. Now, what is the significance of the title, De Mojo Blues?
De Mojo Blues. Mojo is a hoodoo term. It's used a lot in hoodoo mythology. Hoodoo being the Afro-American version of African retention religions, such as voodoo, which is more French and Haitian and New Orleans and Obeah, which is Jamaican, and Santa Rita. There are a lot of different versions, but the Afro-American version is a very assimilated version, just as the Afro-Americans are. It's got a lot of Western technology in it. Mojo is a hoodoo term. Hoodoo is an occult system, a metaphysical system. And mojo is a hoodoo term, and it refers to the power. The power being the life force, you know, the power that permeates all things, other systems call it, you know, by different names, mana, ki, prana, et cetera, laws of nature. And it's used a lot in blues. It's been used a lot in the blues. You've got the old classic blues. I've got my mojo working, and I'm gonna try it on you. Do do do. And you've got I've got Blackhead Bones. Do 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 do. Got mojo too. Do 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 do. Got Johnny Conqueror gonna mess with you. And Johnny Conqueror is also High John. Anyway, and mojo is the power. And the blues, I also proposed as a metaphysical system designed to help individuals not only face the trials and tribulations of life, but extract strength from adversity. Strength, you know, in the sense of being able to face the harsh realities of life, and it, by the use of the blues, to get through them and feel stronger by having grown and learned something from the experience. So by putting the power of the mojo and blues together, what I'm speaking on there is the life being a struggle for survival, i.e. a struggle for power, and when I put the blues as a blues being that it is something that you just have to face and go, and it's just part of living, and not something that should break you, but something that should make you stronger by the correct approach to it.
Well, that's something interesting you just said. The name Haijon, Tusef Haijon, did not come out of left field. Oh. That was a very deliberate use of that name, because it related to the Haijon root, I think you said.
Right. Yeah, it's the Haijon character is an old black folklore character, supposedly, and he's been used before by Zora Neale Hurston. Did a piece on Haijon the Conqueror, where she interpreted the Haijon myth, and I interpreted it somewhat differently, but along the same line. And the Haijon myth, there's a root called the Haijon the Conqueror root that's in which the spirit of Haijon is supposed to reside. That's used as a good luck charm and as just a basic amulet. But the Haijon the Conqueror was supposed to be a tricking man during slavery that helped the blacks survive slavery and cross over to the other side. There are a lot of Haijon oral folk tales about Haijon and Old Massa and how they would be maneuvering with each other, and how Haijon is supposed to be a champion of the slaves. And the after slavery, supposedly, according to the folklore, Haijon was no longer needed. And Haijon, one of Haijon's qualities, in addition to the helping survive, was helping to survive with a sense of humor about the situation, a sense of ironic amusement, I'd say, that allowed you to go ahead and survive such a hammer, such a social hammer. And after slavery, according to the folklore, Haijon was no longer needed, and his spirit retreated to this root, which is this funny little root that is prevalent through the South. And supposedly will come back whenever the race needs him. So I play it off of that myth.
Oh, you've got lots of real neat touches. Tusef Haijon, of course, becomes a root doctor and hangs out his shingle because his father is a doctor. It runs in the family. Very nice. It was interesting to me, going back to the language a little bit. I was talking to Amiri Baraka a while ago, and he told me that he's bilingual and his kids are bilingual. I thought this was an interesting phraseology, because he says his kids are growing up on the streets of Newark in a poor neighborhood. And so when they go out and they talk to the kids who live in the neighborhood, their language is a lot different from what they speak in the house. And so is Mary Baracus, because when he teaches at Stony Brook and when he teaches at Columbia, he adopts the regular English idiom.
Right.
But when he goes back to Newark in his neighborhood, he adopts, I don't know if the language is the same, because a lot of these things apparently came out of Vietnam, but there must be some carryover or overlap. Maybe you, why don't you tell me a little bit about the use of language among blacks that seems to be different from the regular English idiom.
I called myself writing in the idiom, and I don't know, let me see exactly what the difference is. I used a lot of the classic differences, throw a lot of B's in, I be going, and used a lot of the idiomatic terminology, but I really tried to not get bogged down in a dialect narrative, as because I wanted a certain conventional elegance, and at the same time I wanted to use the black idiom, so I called myself mixing the two, because in the, as you say, there is a bilingual sense where you have one phraseology for one circumstance and another for another. And because of the fact that, as I said, I'm in Killens' literary line, and Killens has made extensive use of idiomatic narrative. So I did call myself attempting to forge a literary voice using a black idiom that would, because it was used in context, be clear to, you know, a broader audience. I did, and I tried to be poetic about it, and used a lot of the poetic structure that's used in the blues, and whereas I tried, whereas there's a certain sense of ambiguity about literature that I enjoy trying to use, that will allow you to interpret on different levels a particular phrase or word used in context, but I tried to guide the direction of interpretation, but leave it open to interact with the reader's experience. And if I'd say that there's a difference, there's a degree more of experimentation with the language that we're allowed because it's understood that it's a riff on the basic melody. A riff being such as if, you know, in jazz where the basic melody goes da 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 and you go do da 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 da. You know, I did consider myself, I'm trying to forge a literary voice using
it. There's no question that it worked. There was a problem with black slang words, as it is with mainstream slang words, is that they are perishable and they do go out of date.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the things, I grew up in the 50s, my formative teenage years in the 50s, and I know that a lot of the words that I used then, if I were to use them to my teenage boy today, he would have the slightest hour. He'd think I'm nut. Words have gone out of date. Let me ask you a little bit about Vietnam. Now, you did not serve in combat in Vietnam, but it must have been a traumatic experience, and one that apparently, if this is correct, in the Mojo Blues, did seem to forge a great deal of solidarity among black servicemen. Can you tell me a little bit about what that experience was like for you and perhaps other blacks?
Right. Because I took that a lot from my fellow veterans, and I did. I was close enough to experience it.
Of course, Tusup Hai John states very specifically in the Demojo Blues that he went to Vietnam because he wanted to kill.
Wanted to go to war.
Go to war, yeah. It's crazy, something like that. Yeah.
He had a lot of idea, romanticism in him about what war was about, and the ritual of manhood therein. The blackinization phenomenon jailed in Vietnam because it was a very hostile environment. Quite literally a life and death environment. And in the search for security, there was this automatic me and you, brother, situation. In the case of any perceived discrimination, whereas in the States it would be just a matter of social stature, in Vietnam it became life and death. If you were put on all of the points, or if you were given all of the dangerous details, it was just a life and death situation. So there was this reaching out that because when I got there, the black survival network was already in place, so you just plugged into it, and it worked. So there was this there was a whole different feel about being black in Vietnam. There was a certain pride that was foreign to a lot of black soldiers, and that they've been reluctant to give up upon return to the States.
The Vietnam experience was so bad for this country, and the war was so unpopular that the Vietnam veterans came home without being saluted. There were no parades for them until a year or so ago, and that seemed to be kind of a makeshift parade. Did the blacks feel, in the black servicemen, feel the same sense of discouragement and letdown that the servicemen in general felt?
I would have to say so, definitely, and probably a little even more so, because a lot of it was that we were ambiguous about just what we had done about service in Vietnam. The same questioning spirit that motivated our generation here in the States also worked on their peers in Vietnam, and so that even more so, you know, it was a very classic case of a disillusioned colonial army. So to come back and into that ambiguous environment and it was traumatic, and if you were black, even more so, because you were even more accused of doing wrong.
Well, we're almost out of time. I did want to get this in. Tell me a little bit about the New Renaissance Writers Guild. How you are involved in that?
New Renaissance grew out of the Harlem Writers Guild. The Harlem Writers Guild is an venerable institution in the black literary community. It's been in existence about 30 years, and quite a few of the name elder black writers are involved in it. We, the younger writers, were members of it, and we had we reached a period where we wanted to do more than the Harlem Writers Guild, and so it became conflictual. Because we formed the New Renaissance Writers Guild, we've been in training for some time.
Now you're the director, is that right?
Yeah, I'm the director.
Now, how does it function? How many people are in it, and what do they do?
Well, there are 12 of us now, and we have biweekly workshops, writers workshops at the Schoenberg Center. And we are in process of incorporating and starting a journal. We're trying to operate as a guild, as a professional guild, we're trying to be a literary mob is what we're trying to do, you know, in the classic sense of the word. We really want to make a living as writers.
Did the New Renaissance Writers Guild, your work in that, play a role in the completion of the DeMojo Blues?
I would have to say so. I've been in workshops. The New Renaissance, I've been in John O'Killen's workshop and the Harlem Guild, Writers Guild workshop since I've been here in New York. And, I consider myself a relatively well-trained writer.
You say you have weekly meetings. Do you read, does each person read his work? It's critiqued and
yeah.
You work with each other?
Right.
That's a wonderful feeling of getting support.
Yeah. And it cleans, you get a lot of feedback on just how your piece is impacting on others.
Because writing is such a solitary profession that many writers who don't associate with other writers sit there and they write something, have no idea what it's like.
Right.
You can look at a piece of writing over and over, and so that you can't see it or hear it or read it anymore. You don't know how it sounds.
Right.
There's nobody to give you ideas.
And in addition, we get a lot of spiritual support from each other. There are times when you feel like, what's the use? But you realize that you've got others who are just as committed, going through the same problems, the same hassles, and you don't feel as if you're out there on your own making a fool of yourself.
Where do you meet?
At the Schoenberg Center, the Schoenberg Library.
You did a nice job of describing Memphis and the Mojo Blues. I know you grew up there. I like your descriptions of Beale Street and how it had changed.
Thank you.
Do you get back to Memphis?
I go back pretty regular. I usually try to make the Christmas season, go home.
Family still there.
Family, yeah.
Doctor? Father, yeah, doctor?
Of course.
And you, of course, the root doctor.
Right, in a literary sense.
Well, you obviously put your heart into the Mojo Blues, and I think the novel worked, and I congratulate you. I found it eminently readable.
Thank you.
And I'm glad that I had you directly to interpret some of the words for me. That was helpful. Did you bring your harmonica?
I
just wonder if you might want to, as perhaps a little bed. Maybe I could open the broadcast with just a little bit.
I just bought a new one.
Well, it may not work.
Well, it's not bent to my taste yet. But I'm sure I can get it. A whole blues harp. Blues harp. They make a blues harp now.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a couple of those. Don't play them well. But.
Well, you know, with some harp playing, maybe not that particular one, but yeah, I do it.
Oh, that's good. You're not self-taught. I guess everybody has to be self-taught.
Yeah,
harmonica.
To a certain extent.
Unless you have Sonny Terry and Ronnie McGee there standing over your shoulder.
Right, but actually I'm not as much self-taught as that, because I did get some basic pointers from this brother that plays on the streets of New York called Sugar Blue. And he taught me how to draw and how to bend. And other than that, I've just been listening to Stevie Wonder on the record players.
Well, Arthur Flowers, you certainly made an auspicious debut as a novelist. And
thank you.
I know that you're not going to stop after this.
Oh, no, I hope to do a lot better on
the second. A new project.
Oh, yeah.
Because it must be at least a year or so that goes by since you finished the book and comes out.
Yeah. On my second novel, it's going to be a type rather than this wide canvas that I like. I want to experiment with just focusing on two characters, so I'm doing a love story, even though it's in the same. It's a love story between a mad blues piano player and an Arkansas conjure woman. Takes place in the Delta around 1900.
The blues and the conjure. Got to get New York City in, aren't you, a little bit?
Well, in my third one, I'm going back to my wide screen. In this one, I want to focus on characters.
Unless they get rid of Bookbeat between now and the new novel, I hope that I can get you to come back and we'll talk about that.
I'd be looking forward to it. I enjoyed this one.
Maybe at some point I could do a little more detail on the New Renaissance Writers Guild.
That would be a bit.
Maybe do a little more work on that.
Yeah, we've got three novels coming out this year.
Members of the group?
Three novels and about four in negotiation for next year.
It's working. Arthur Flowers, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me. I've enjoyed myself.